This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is Ed Goldman. This is the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Here are today's top stories. Israel seizes border crossing amid revived ceasefire talks, by Anat Peled and Samer Said. It's Stateline Tel Aviv. Israel sent tanks into Rafah and took control of the Gaza side of a key border crossing to Egypt, securing a strategic corridor as high-stakes negotiations for a truce and hostage releases intensified. Israeli military footage showed its tanks moving in on the Rafah border crossing, outside the southern Gaza city, where more than 1 million people are sheltering from the war. The operation followed a series of Israeli airstrikes against Hamas targets and warnings to civilians in the eastern part of Rafah to move to zones in the west as Israel prepares for a military offensive. Negotiations toward a ceasefire deal resumed in Cairo after an Israeli delegation, Hamas officials, mediators from Qatar, and Central Intelligence Agency Director William Burns arrived in the Egyptian capital on Tuesday. Burns was expected to travel to Israel on Wednesday. As the Biden administration tried to help mediate a ceasefire and stave off a large-scale military offensive in Rafah that would endanger civilian lives, U.S. officials expressed some optimism about the prospects of a deal. A close assessment of the two sides' positions suggests that they should be able to close the remaining gaps, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said. Hamas said Monday that it had agreed to a ceasefire pact that would involve an exchange of hostages abducted by the group on October 7th for Palestinian prisoners in Israel. But the group added conditions that Israel hadn't approved, including a complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and an end to the Israeli blockade on the enclave. Hamas, which the U.S. designates as a terrorist organization, has since offered some amendments to its Monday proposal, U.S. officials said. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said that the Hamas proposal on Monday fell short and that he had instructed the Israeli delegation in Cairo to insist on the conditions that Israel requires for its security. In quotes, "Hamas yesterday intended to sabotage the entry of our forces into Rafah," end quote, by saying it had agreed to a truce deal, Netanyahu said Tuesday. Quote, "It did not happen," he said. Netanyahu has said Israel's military needs to break up four remaining Hamas battalions in Rafah to achieve the goal of destroying the group's ability to attack Israel. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant drew a connection between the Rafah operation on Tuesday and the hostage negotiations, saying that the operation would continue, quote, "until we eliminate Hamas in the Rafah area and the entire Gaza Strip, or until the first hostage returns," end quote. Israel's military described the operation at the Rafah crossing as, quote, "very precise and limited in space," end quote, aimed at eliminating Hamas militant infrastructure. U.S. officials also described the operation as narrow, not the large-scale Rafah offensive that the Biden administration has warned against. Israel told the U.S. that the moves on Tuesday aimed to cut off Hamas's ability to smuggle weapons and funds into Gaza, Kirby said. Hamas called Israel's operation a dangerous escalation that would harm the flow of humanitarian aid to Rafah. The group called for U.S. and other international pressure on Israel, quote, "to stop this escalation that threatens the lives of hundreds of thousands of displaced civilians in Rafah and the entire Gaza Strip," end quote. The operation at the Rafah crossing came after Hamas fired rockets and mortars at the Israeli-controlled Kerem Shalom border crossing on Sunday, killing four soldiers and wounding several others. Kerem Shalom, one of two main entryways for aid into Gaza along with the Rafah crossing, remained closed on Tuesday, Israel said. Hamas's military wing claimed responsibility on Tuesday morning for another rocket barrage on Kerem Shalom. The Israeli military said rockets and mortars had been fired at Israeli territory from Rafah, but that there were no injuries. The move to take the Rafah crossing was directly tied to negotiations and aimed at increasing pressure on Hamas, sending the message that the Israeli military can operate where it likes, analysts said. If Hamas will not go into a deal, Israel is keen to go further into Rafah, end quote, but could potentially stop with the crossing, said Israel Ziv, a former commander of the Israeli military's Gaza division. The Israeli government has maintained from the start of the war that the only way to bring Hamas to the negotiating table is through military pressure. The seizure of the Rafah crossing positions the military to launch a border operation if talks collapse. Around 20 militants were killed during the Israeli operation to seize the crossing, and 3 tunnel shafts were discovered, according to the Israeli military. An explosive-laden car driving toward Israeli troops was struck. No Israeli soldiers were injured, the military said. The Gaza Strip is ensnared in a humanitarian crisis, with potential famine and an acute shortage of fuel. The United States warned that the cutoff of the 2 main arteries for aid imperils humanitarian operations that serve the entire population of some 2.2 million people. The U.S. pressed for the reopening of both crossings to facilitate humanitarian aid, a State Department spokesperson said. An Israeli official said that as long as Hamas was firing at the Kerem Shalom crossing, Israel couldn't open it. Quote, Hamas is stopping the aid, end quote, the official said. More than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the offensive in Gaza, most of them civilians, according to the Palestinian authorities, who don't specify how many were combatants. Israel invaded Gaza after Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7th killed some 1,200 people, most of them civilians, according to Israel. Gordon Lubold, Kerry Keller-Lynn, and Stephen Kalin contributed to this article. And there's a photograph of Israeli tanks moving in on the Gazan side of the Rafah crossing to Egypt. Sexual misdeeds, bullying, found at FDIC. And the subtitle is Scathing Report Chronicles Rampant Abuses at Agency, Chairs Anger Issues, by Rebecca Ballhaus and Andrew Ackerman. Sexual harassment, bullying, and discrimination have long pervaded the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, with perpetrators often receiving reassignments and even promotions, according to a blistering report on the agency's culture that calls into question the leadership of Chairman Martin Grunberg. The report, crafted by law firm Cleary Gottlieb Steen and Hamilton and released Tuesday, was commissioned by the FDIC after a Wall Street Journal investigation in November revealed a toxic workplace culture at the agency. Investigators spoke to more than 500 employees at the bank regulator out of fewer than 6,000, most of them current, who painfully and emotionally, in quotes, recounted their experiences of misconduct at the agency, according to the report. Quote, they deserve and demand a workforce free of sexual harassment, discrimination, and interpersonal misconduct, end quote, the report said. Quotes, but for too many, they did not have it. The 234-page report includes examples of brazen misconduct. Executives who were known for pursuing and having relationships with subordinates were promoted or moved to other regions or divisions rather than face discipline. One senior FDIC examiner sent a woman a picture of his private parts, while another was known for going to brothels with colleagues during work trips. A Hispanic employee was asked by a colleague to recite the Pledge of Allegiance to, quote, prove that they were American, end quote. The journal reported that many female bank examiners quit as a result of such experiences. Investigators also confirmed that multiple employees experienced, quote, extremely difficult and volatile, end quote, interactions with Grunberg, a Democrat who has spent nearly 2 decades at the FDIC. FDIC employees, including senior leaders, felt, quote, disrespected, disparaged, and treated unfairly, end quote, by Grunberg, and said the chairman was perceived as someone, quote, who could not control his temper. after the journal's investigation was published, with reports that Grunberg had repeatedly berated staffers, he said he had been generally unaware of allegations of a toxic culture and resisted calls from Republican lawmakers to resign. The report didn't make a recommendation as to whether Grunberg and other senior leaders should face discipline or removal, which was outside investigators' scope. But it said Grunberg's long tenure and reputation for losing his temper with staff, quote, presents unique challenges, end quote, for him to spearhead the cultural and structural overhaul that it said is needed, and questioned whether he has the, quote, moral authority to do so. Those dynamics, investigators said, quote, may hinder his ability to establish trust and confidence in leading meaningful culture change, and so, too, may his apparent inability or unwillingness to recognize how others experience certain difficult interactions with him, end quote. Grunberg, nominated by President Biden to lead the agency for a second term in 2022, joined the FDIC board in August 2005 and has led the agency for nearly 10 of the last 13 years. As a presidential nominee, he can be pushed out only by the president. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre didn't directly answer when asked at a briefing if Biden still had confidence in Grunberg. But she noted that the FDIC chief had, quote, apologized and has committed to the recommendations, quote, end quote, in Tuesday's report. In a message to staff Tuesday before the report's release, Grunberg said employees, quote, reported painful experiences of mistreatment and feelings of fear, anger, and sadness. Continuing the quote, to anyone who experienced sexual harassment or other misconduct at the FDIC, I again want to express how very sorry I am, he wrote. I also want to apologize for any shortcomings on my part, end quote. Some lawmakers in both parties Tuesday called for Grunberg, 71 years old, to resign. The GOP chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, said the report, quote, makes clear new leadership is needed, end quote. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, called for Biden to order the Justice Department to investigate the agency, quote, top to bottom. Senator Bill Hagerty, Republican from Tennessee, a member of the Senate Banking Committee, called for the panel to hold a hearing on the findings. Grunberg is set to testify next week alongside other regulators in previously scheduled hearings. Members of the special committee that the FDIC formed to oversee the probe said they were deeply troubled by the findings. Quote, today's report establishes the urgent imperative of a cultural transformation at the FDIC led by those with the leadership capacity to effectuate that change, end quote, said Jonathan McKernan, a Republican board member and co-chair of the special committee. Michael Hsu, a Democratic board member and the committee co-chair, said the report was thorough and nonpartisan. Linda Miller, CEO of the consulting firm Audient Group and one of the committee's non-voting members, said the accountability recommendations in the report didn't go far enough to address the problem and called for the FDIC to establish a mandatory 14-day suspension policy for staff who are credibly accused of sexual harassment, among other measures. Problems with the agency's culture have been raised internally, including to senior leadership, but the responses have been insufficient, the report said. One FDIC executive told the law firm that wrongdoers can expect that the FDIC will, quote, pay, promote, or move them, end quote. Investigators described the agency's culture as, quote, patriarchal, insular, and risk-averse. Widespread fear of retaliation and a, quote, lack of clarity and credibility around internal reporting channels, end quote, have driven an underreporting of misconduct, the report said. Some 97 people reported 145 incidents of sexual assaults, unwelcome sexual advances, unwanted touching, and attention, and other sexual conduct. 91 additional people reported 141 incidents of gender or sexuality-based discrimination. Some 187 people reported 320 incidents of bullying, threats, and other verbal abuse, and 191 people reported 295 incidents of other discrimination, including racial. One Hispanic employee who organized diversity initiatives was asked by a colleague, quote, "When will we have a white man's day/month? End quote. Another employee was told, quote, "You're a mother now, you don't belong in the workplace." End quote. The agency faces other external investigations, including from House lawmakers and its inspector general. Grunberg told investigators he didn't recall, quote, "ever getting angry in meetings with FDIC employees," end quote. The report included a number of incidents that suggest otherwise. In a May 2023 meeting, Grunberg subjected participants to what one described as, quote, 45 minutes of vitriol, end quote, and threatened to, quote, fire or reassign anybody he wanted, end quote. The report documents four other incidents of Grunberg losing his temper, including one in which he threw papers against the wall in anger. Grunberg, in his interview with investigators, denied throwing anything during a meeting. After the Journal reported on his temper, a senior executive in a meeting with Grunberg and others was frustrated by Grunberg questioning the accuracy of the report and told him that it, quote, "accurately reflected Chairman Grunberg's leadership style, and everyone in the room was afraid to tell him that," end quote. That led to a, quote, "tense and awkward discussion among the senior staff about the respective interactions with him," end quote. One participant in a 2007 meeting in which Grunberg lost his temper told investigators, quote, "In my entire career of 35 years, I've never had anybody treat me like that," end quote. A House hearing in November yielded an uncomfortable moment in which Grunberg was forced to correct the record on whether he had ever been investigated over inappropriate behavior. He initially told the committee he had never been the subject of such an investigation. But after the Journal requested comment from the FDIC on a 2008 investigation following an incident in which a senior female employee said he lost his temper with her, Grunberg revised his testimony and confirmed he had been investigated. A departure by Grunberg would leave FDIC Vice Chairman Travis Hill, a Republican, as the agency's acting chairman. In parentheses, Hill is a former staffer at the agency who has served on the 5-member board for about a year. That could make it more challenging for Biden-appointed Democrats to complete new requirements for larger banks to shore up their financial footing. The report also documented multiple structural problems at the FDIC. For one, the FDIC doesn't have a policy on intimate relationships between employees, including between supervisors and subordinates. As a result, investigators said, the agency has a culture in which, quote, pursuing romantic relationships with colleagues, including subordinates, has not been viewed as problematic, end quote. A former field office supervisor pursued and had relationships with junior staffers, including student interns. When he was reported to the regional office for having a relationship with an intern, he wasn't disciplined. While on a work trip, a former executive was thrown out of a strip club for inappropriately touching dancers and subsequently asked an employee during a cab ride, "Does your husband eat you?" in quotes. In parentheses, she never reported it because she didn't know who to tell and didn't think anyone would believe her. Another executive asked an employee how far away she lived and suggested they could, quote, "get there and back before the end of the day," end quote. An employee told investigators that a former executive in headquarters had, quote, "grabbed her and rubbed himself on her after a happy hour," end quote. Women in one field office said their supervisor routinely talked about their breasts, their legs, and his sex life. One employee recounted sexual harassment from a more senior examiner that continued over 6 years and included sending her text messages of partially clothed women, including one that included the words, quote, "get naked, bitch," end quote. The alleged harassment continued even after she filed a complaint against him. Of the 92 harassment complaints the agency received between 2015 and 2023, none resulted in a removal, demotion, or pay cut. Of those, 76 led to no discipline at all. In 12, the perpetrators received counseling warnings, or training. In two, they were suspended, and in another two, they received letters of reprimand. Among the recommendations of the report was the appointment of an external, quote, transformation monitor to audit the FDIC's work to address its problems, the creation of a 360-degree review process for the chairman and other senior leaders, improved training, and improved disciplinary processes and record-keeping. In his message to staff on Tuesday, Grunberg cited a 13-page action plan the agency released in December, outlining steps it would take to address its cultural issues. The FDIC subsequently established multiple task forces led by senior leaders at the agency. Many employees privately expressed skepticism about leaders' willingness to overhaul the culture. In recent months, in particular, employees said things had largely reverted to normal. This report was commissioned after a Wall Street Journal report in November. Okay. Also on the front page, there is a photograph of President Biden, House Speaker Mike Johnson, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries holding images. They're standing in front of a large group of congresspeople and senators. They're holding images of Holocaust victims at a remembrance ceremony on the Capitol on Tuesday. And the title of the photograph says, Holocaust Remembrance Day Observed Amid War. Okay, our next article is headlined, TikTok Files Suit in Attempt to Block, Divest, or Ban Law, by Jacob Gershman and Megan Bobrowski. TikTok filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday challenging the constitutionality of a new law that requires a sale or ban of the popular social media app, setting up a court showdown over national security and free speech in the age of global information wars. The suit, filed directly with a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C., seeks a court order preventing the U.S. from enforcing the bipartisan law signed by President Biden last month. The measure bans Chinese-backed TikTok in the U.S. unless its parent company, ByteDance, divests itself of the platform by mid-January. Beijing-based ByteDance has said it can't and won't sell its U.S. operations by the deadline, leaving litigation as its best hope to maintain its U.S. market. The lawsuit accuses the government of trampling on TikTok's First Amendment rights, as well as the free speech rights of millions of U.S. citizens, under the banner of national security. Quote, there is no question the act will force a shutdown of TikTok by January 19, 2025, end quote, the lawsuit states, quote, silencing the 170 million Americans who use the platform to communicate in ways that cannot be replicated elsewhere, end quote. The suit also alleges the U.S. ban is an unconstitutional legislative punishment of TikTok, denies the company equal protection under the law, and amounts to an unlawful taking of private property. The short-form video platform, which has operated as TikTok in the U.S. since 2018, quickly gained mass appeal as an entertainment platform, news source, cultural tastemaker, and activist hub. More than half of all U.S. adults ages 18 to 29 use TikTok, according to the Pew Research Center. About 4 in 10 TikTok users say they regularly get news from the app, double the number of people who said they did in 2020. National security officials and federal lawmakers have watched its growth with alarm. Supporters of the law have said TikTok offers a foreign adversary a potent tool to spy on people and manipulate public opinion through its algorithms. Forcing TikTok to cut ties with China is the only effective way to deal with the security risks, they said. TikTok has said it has taken measures to safeguard user data and prevent Chinese government influence. The U.S. has long restricted foreign ownership of radio and television broadcasting, but Congress has never taken such drastic actions against an internet platform used by millions of people. For now, life on TikTok is operating as usual. High-profile users are continuing to post content, and TikTok is telling advertisers not to worry. At a conference in New York last week, one of TikTok's business leaders told a room of 300 media executives that the company isn't backing down in its fight to stay in the U.S. TikTok doesn't comment publicly on its financials, but going into 2024, it wasn't yet profitable, according to people familiar with the matter. TikTok ad sales in the U.S. are expected to grow 31% this year to $8.7 billion, according to estimates from eMarketer, an outside firm. The platform is investigating heavily to build out a shopping feature that could potentially rival Amazon one day, with users buying and selling items directly on the platform. If ByteDance were to try to sell off TikTok's U.S. operations, it is unclear what price it could fetch. One potential suitor has suggested $20 billion as a starting price for its U.S. operations. But divestiture in any meaningful sense seems to be off the table, since the Chinese government has indicated it will not allow a forced sale of the app. Courts previously ruled against some federal and state restrictions on TikTok, but have left the First Amendment issues unsettled. A federal judge in Washington ruled against Commerce Department efforts to ban TikTok during the Trump administration, deciding that the agency exceeded its authority under a 1970s law, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. In a separate Pennsylvania case, another U.S. district judge, citing similar legal grounds, sided with a group of TikTok stars that sued the Trump administration. The current case is difficult because it is Congress that took the action, after classified briefings, rather than the White House trying to claim authority for a ban under a decades-old law. The GOP-led House passed the bill overwhelmingly in March. The Senate then took a more cautious view of the legislation, but ultimately approved it after extending the time period for TikTok to find a buyer. TikTok is already restricted on federal government smartphones. Many states have also banned the platform on state government devices. Several Supreme Court precedents could be relevant in the legal fight, including a 1965 case in which the High Court said citizens have a right to receive information, even if it is foreign propaganda. The Justice Department, which will defend the government in the lawsuit, declined to comment on it. And we see a photograph of TikTok owned by China-based ByteDance. Okay, our next article is Porn Star Daniels Details Trump Tryst by James Finelli, Aaron Mulvaney, and Corinne Ramey. Donald Trump greeted adult film actress Stormy Daniels in silky pajamas at his penthouse suite in a Lake Tahoe hotel in 2006, she told jurors Tuesday at his hush money trial. Quote, "I said, does Mr. Hefner know you stole his pajamas?" End quote. Daniels recalled joking when she saw him, referring to Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy magazine, who was known for wearing a similar outfit. The two later had sex, Daniels testified, and after it was over, she remembered her hands shaking as she tried to buckle her high-heeled gold shoes. As she was preparing to leave, Trump expressed interest in another meeting, she said. Quote, "Let's keep in touch, honey bunch," end quote, she recalled him saying. The brief sexual encounter is at the heart of the trial, in which Manhattan prosecutors allege Trump falsified business records to conceal a $130,000 payment to Daniels on the eve of the 2016 election to buy her silence. The payment came during a critical moment in his first presidential campaign, prosecutors said. At the time, Trump was under scrutiny after, quote, "Access Hollywood," end quote, tape surfaced of him describing how he groped women. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee has denied the affair and any wrongdoing. He has said Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat whose office brought the case, charged him with 34 felony counts out of political spite. The case is one of four prosecutions Trump is facing and could be the only one to go to trial before the election. Trump received welcome news Tuesday in another of the cases when the federal judge presiding over his prosecution in South Florida indefinitely delayed his trial on charges he mishandled classified documents. The trial previously was scheduled to begin May 20th, though both sides had been anticipating the date would slip because the judge has been slow in addressing pretrial matters. For Manhattan prosecutors, putting Daniels, 45 years old, on the stand was a gamble. Her testimony helped bolster the account of her former lawyer, Keith Davidson, and gave jurors a firsthand look at her efforts to sell her story and negotiations around her silence. Trump's lawyers raised objections over what she told the jury and later demanded a mistrial. They accused Daniels of changing her story and of providing details outside the scope of the trial. Daniels said at one point she blacked out during the encounter, but clarified she wasn't drunk or drugged. Todd Blanche, a Trump lawyer, said Daniels' testimony was meant to inflame the jury and wrongfully raise questions about whether the sex was consensual. "There was no way to unring the bell in our view," Blanche said. Justice Juan Merchan denied the mistrial bid, but acknowledged that some of Daniels' testimony would, quote, "probably have been better left unsaid," end quote. The judge said a prosecutor spoke to Daniels about her testimony before she returned in the afternoon. Earlier in the day, Daniels testified how she met Trump at a 2006 celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe, Nevada, and he later invited her to dinner at his hotel. Trump had been impressed when he learned Daniels was involved in a production as well as acting, she said. At the time, Daniels, then 27, said she had recognized Trump from his reality show, commercials, and cameos on professional wrestling programs. "I didn't know his age, but I knew he was older than my father," said Daniels, wearing a black dress and hooded sweater with her bleached blonde hair pulled back in a messy bun. Trump, now 77, was 60 years old at the time of the golf tournament. Trump, seated at the defense table, stared blankly at Daniels when she first took the witness stand, but furrowed his brow on occasion as she joked about the run-up to the short-lived tryst. Throughout her hours-long testimony, he frowned at times and appeared to be listening intently, but also kept his eyes closed for extended periods. In a bench conversation between Merchan and lawyers that couldn't be heard elsewhere in the courtroom, the judge said he could hear Trump cursing during Daniels' testimony and asked Blanche to speak to his client. Quote, "It has the potential to intimidate the witness, and the jury can see that," end quote, the judge said, according to a trial transcript. Daniels recalled that throughout the evening, her date peppered her with unusual questions about the adult film industry, including whether there was a union. Quote, "Most people who talk to me about work, they want to know the sexy stuff," she said. These were the more thought-out business questions. Trump also dangled the prospect of her appearing on his show, The Apprentice, she said. Quote, "You remind me of my daughter. She is smart and blonde and beautiful, and people underestimate her as well," end quote, Daniels recalled Trump saying. Daniels described having sex with Trump as a whirlwind. She walked out of the bathroom in the hotel room, she said, and was surprised when she saw him lying on a bed waiting for her. She said the sex was brief. Afterward, Trump said they were, quote, "great together," she said. She left soon after. Daniels testified that they saw each other at various public places, including at Trump Tower and once in Los Angeles, where she said she rejected his sexual advances. Daniels said that in October 2016, she learned that Trump and his then-personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, were willing to pay her to sign a non-disclosure agreement. She said she thought the agreement was the best scenario because she didn't want her husband at the time to find out. She said about being paid, quote, "it's money, but the number didn't matter to me, and I didn't pick the number," she told jurors. On cross-examination, Trump's lawyer, Susan Nicholas, asked Daniels about past comments she has made, including a tweet where she called the former president, quote, "an orange turd," end quote. In a line of confrontational questioning, Nicholas asked Daniels if she despises Trump and whether she has made fun of his looks the same way he did when he called her, quote, "horseface" and, quote, "sleazebag." Daniels responded, quote, "because he made fun of me first," Daniels acknowledged that she has been paid for her story, at times, but insisted she is telling the truth and didn't always tell full accounts publicly. Quote, "None of this is made up," she said. Netchulis also said, "Do you want President Trump to go to jail?" Quote, "I want him to be accountable," she responded. That's the end of the article. C. Ryan Barber contributed to this article. And there's a sketch of the courtroom, colored chalk drawing with the judge in the top left, former president in the bottom left, Stormy Daniels testifying on the right and the back of one of the lawyers. The next article, entitled "Huge Project Hits Wall in Saudi Arabia." The subtitle is "Crown Prince's Plans for a 105-mile-long skyscraper Faces Glitches, Soaring Costs." The byline is "Elliot Brown and Rory Jones." The engineers saw a mountain-sized problem. For weeks, thousands of trucks and diggers had worked 24 hours every day scooping millions of cubic feet of sand at the world's biggest construction project, known as NEOM, in Saudi Arabia. But the workers had dumped the massive pile of dirt, now hundreds of feet wide, in the very spot where architects planned to dig a waterway out to the Red Sea. So the trucks and diggers went back to work, picking it all back up and making a new mountain of sand nearby in a costly hiccup that epitomizes the Saudi project's turbulent journey from an audacious concept to a sprawling operation that has faltered in its execution. Defying skeptics, Saudi Arabia is barreling ahead with hundreds of billions of dollars in projects at NEOM, a built-from-scratch region the size of Massachusetts, typified by a sci-fi architecture, an arid ski resort, and a laundry list of flashy projects meant to attract a population larger than New York City's. None is more brazen than a multi-trillion-dollar pair of skyscrapers taller than the Empire State Building, designed to run 105 miles long and house 9 million people, the flagship development dubbed The Line. Its champion, Saudi Crown Prince and de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman, has likened the project to Egypt's Great Pyramids. The kingdom in recent months downsized The Line's first phase, facing the reality of costs at a time the country is spending far more than it is taking in. Now organizers plan to initially build around 1.5 miles of the structure by 2030, rather than the roughly 10-mile first chunk that had previously been envisioned, multiple people briefed on the plans said. Still, even that truncated section would be by far the world's largest building, the equivalent of more than 60 Empire State Buildings of square footage. Asked in a CNBC interview last month about a Bloomberg report on the scaled-back first phase, Saudi Minister of Economy and Planning Faisal Al-Ibrahim signaled that the long-term ambitions for the line remain the same. "There is no change in scale," this is a quote, "there is no change in scale. It is a long-term project that is modular in design," he said, adding that, "Today, the economy in the kingdom is growing faster, but we don't want to overheat it," end quote. The title of the next section is "Outsize Stakes." The stakes for Saudi Arabia are as outsized as Mohammed's ambition. NEOM is the ultimate symbol of its plans to transform the kingdom's economy, reduce its dependence on oil revenue, and make it a magnet for money and talent from around the world. But he risks squandering much of the country's cash on an unprecedented experiment in city building that could prove too difficult to deliver. "Mohammed bin Salman is gambling here," said Madawi al-Rashid, a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and a member of the group calling for democratic reform in Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy. "Spending so much money should, in theory, generate a tangible leap in the Saudi economy," she said. "But much of the cash so far was spent on foreign consultants and architects." A mountain of challenges lies ahead. More than 100,000 additional construction workers must be housed in a barren corner of the kingdom's vast desert, 2 hours' drive from any sizable city. Neom's need for steel, exterior glass, and other materials are so massive they may push up global prices and be difficult to source. Planners worry about the unique central concept of the line, the vertical city housed in twin skyscrapers the length of Delaware, could prove to be an unappealing place to live. At the same time, the scaled-back plans for the line put a spotlight on Neom's enormous bill for what is now poised to be a mid-sized city. Neom executives now expect fewer than 200,000 residents in the project's first phase, the population of Knoxville, Tennessee, a current and former employee familiar with the plan said. Yet Neom is spending on vast infrastructure intended for millions of people, including a giant airport, a high-speed train running through a 20-mile mountain tunnel, massive desalination plants, and large civic features such as an opera house, the former executive said. The price tag keeps rising. The projected cost of a ski resort in the region's arid mountains has more than doubled over 2 years to $38 billion as of October, according to Neom documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Real estate advisory Knight Frank estimates that more than $237 billion of construction contracts have already been commissioned at Neom. Even for one of the world's largest exporters of crude oil, Neom might just be too expensive. Its official cost estimate is $500 billion, 50% more than the country's entire federal budget for the year, and more than half the value of its sovereign wealth fund. Executives working on the project dismiss that number as unrealistically low. The first 1.5 miles of the line alone is estimated internally to cost more than $100 billion, two people familiar with the plan said. If it were fully built, Neom employees expect the true price of the line would be well in excess of $2 trillion. Construction costs per square foot are more than double what is standard on other Middle East towers, they said. This makes it unlikely Neom will attract significant private investment to fund future phases of the line, they say. It has been funded thus far by the Saudi government. Neom is the centerpiece of an overhaul of Saudi Arabia's economy and identity that Mohammed began in 2015 when his father ascended the throne. Then 29 years old, the son of King Salman outmaneuvered potential heirs and rapidly consolidated power. Hungry for change, Mohammed allowed more Western cultural norms and eliminated restrictions that forbade mixing of sexes, women drivers, and cinemas. He also put even tighter limits on speech, crushing dissent over the rapid change. The plan, Vision 2030, called for an array of new non-oil industries such as entertainment and technology and building mega-sized real estate developments to help it become a global tourism hub. Mohammed's team sought proposals from the world's top architects for ideas to design Neom. The avant-garde Los Angeles designer Morphosis Architects, headed by Pritzker Prize winner Tom Main, pitched a city that was 100 miles long and 1.2 miles or 2 kilometers wide, with buildings spread across the ground. The prince had a different idea. I told the team, how about if we take that 2 kilo and we flip it to 2 towers to the whole line, he said in a Discovery Channel documentary last year, clapping his hands together vertically like someone closing a book. The idea of the skyscraper was born. Architects got to work designing a pair of parallel towers 650 feet apart, shrouded in a shimmering mirror glass coat that reflects red desert sand and azure blue sea. At their highest, the towers are slated to rise 1,640 feet above the desert floor, although they will be less tall in spots depending on the terrain they are traversing. Internal documents from 2021 call for more than 7 billion square feet of floor space, 29% larger than all of the buildings in New York City put together, and the size of more than 2,000 Empire State Buildings. Apartments, offices, schools, police stations, museums, and a royal palace will be peppered inside. Stunning and costly architecture is a priority. Mohammed told NEOM executives he wants a sense of, quote, zero gravity, end quote, with features appearing to defy physics and float, former executives said. The next section is titled Battling History. A linear city as big as the line is at odds with how humans have developed cities for millennia, naturally building outward in a circular manner, typically around a core. Quote, it's battling against the entire history of the way cities are founded and grow, said John E. Fernandez, professor in the Department of Architecture at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Even supporters say it is an experiment that could easily fail in practice. In a planning document under a heading of Key Concerns, an employee said four different times that by fixating on building miles-long skyscrapers, NEOM had turned the normal design process inside out. Use would normally drive design. We are using design to drive use, the anonymous comment said. The shape has added to challenges. In 2020, before Mohammed unveiled the project, he asked employees to move the line's western end a few miles because he preferred the terrain, and said people familiar with the request, designs had to shift slightly across the entire 105 miles, causing months of extra work. Architects have struggled to find the best ways to mix sunlight and open space in the interior. Internal documents show they wrestled with how to differentiate neighborhoods so as not to create a monolithic block, opting to build distinct half-mile sections with a different look and feel. They worried about drab living conditions at the base of the interior, given that the height of the towers would allow little light down low. According to planning documents, designers proposed leaving gaps atop the modules to bend, in quotes, the structure around the curvature of the earth, which arches about 8 inches per mile. The next section is entitled Bird Hazard. Planners fretted over the billions of birds that fly on a migration route, a less than ideal location for a 1,600-foot-tall glass mirror. Quote, it is inevitable that a significant number of birds will perish, designers wrote, with an illustration of a dead northern flicker. 7 years after launch, little has been completed other than NEOM's film studios and a sprawling new royal complex that boasts giant palaces, a golf course, and at least 10 helipads, satellite images show. Beyond the line, NEOM has a bevy of superlative-packed projects, all of them complex. NEOM is so big it has its own large-scale construction projects simply to prepare for bigger projects. A port is needed to receive materials, and NEOM is spending more than $5 billion to build housing for construction workers, according to the Middle East business trade publication MEED, which tracks NEOM contracts. Engineers and administrative workers live in a handful of NEOM-built communities with schools, basketball courts, a Burger King, a Starbucks, and a Hampton Inn, where rooms run above $400. The first such camp already needs to be partially demolished. After a design change, the line is now due to run right through the community, where housing is already at capacity, former employees said. The next section is entitled Shifting Route. To demonstrate progress to the Crown Prince, engineers started putting in the foundations for the line a couple of years ago, even before architects had figured out what would go above. Architects soon decided the first phase should be built somewhere else, leaving the line's initial foundations abandoned for now, said people familiar with the matter. Another question is height. Numerous executives working on NEOM have questioned the need for a 1,600-foot-tall building, which carries extra engineering challenges, higher costs, and makes evacuation difficult in an emergency. Renowned British architect Peter Cook, who was involved in the line, called the project's height, quote, a bit stupid and unreasonable, according to comments published in the UK-based Architects Journal. In a later documentary, Cook, who is overall praiseful of the project, called the line, quote, puzzling even to those who are involved in designing it. His title, Pro Soccer Rookie is Finance Bro. The subtitle is He's 45, Living His Dream, and Spent Big to Get There, by David Marino Natchison and Patricia Kausman. Earlier this year, a struggling soccer team in Portugal's second division unveiled a new player to help in its battle against relegation. He didn't look like anyone's idea of a star signing. Courtney Rium is a middle-aged American venture capitalist whose soccer career peaked a couple of decades earlier when he played for Colombia in the Ivy League. That didn't prevent Rium from earning a contract with Lanc FC Villaverdense. On January 31st, the final day of European soccer's mid-season transfer window, the club confirmed the former Goldman Sachs investment banker as the newest member of its squad. The curious case of a 45-year-old rookie landing in professional European soccer started 2 years ago when Rium began working with Corey Wolfuck, an ex-pro player turned biotech executive. Wolfuck's own company, Pitchwise Holdings, invests in soccer businesses, and he spent months searching for a team willing to let Rium fulfill his unusual goal, getting on the field himself. I kind of wanted to have this experience I maybe could have had or would have liked to have had 20 or 25 years ago, Rium said. Wolfuck zeroed in on Turkey, Scandinavia, and Portugal, where Rium, who lacks a European passport, might be eligible to play, finding about 10 candidate clubs in all. Quote, not all the other teams were so enthusiastic, Wolfuck said. Villaverdense took a chance on Rium, enticed by more than his sports skills. Rium's deal with the team included a loan, described as in six figures, to ease the club's financial pressure, as well as potential future investment and access to Rium's extensive business and finance network. Rium spent five figures on a 10-week crash course administered by a team of trainers, coaches, and doctors, all to try and make a substitute appearance. Rium, once a men's fitness cover model, was already in good shape before his training began. As an investor in Monarch Athletic Club, he had been using its custom services, including nutrition, sleep, strength, movement, and metabolic panels, for about 4 years. That made his tight timeline for reaching match fitness manageable, according to Dr. Ryan Green, Monarch's co-founder. Former Monarch Dr. Nati Schnittman, now based in Scottsdale, Arizona, added soccer-oriented strength and conditioning. Training continued even when Rium suffered groin and hamstring injuries, the latter of which kept him from running for days. There was no time to waste. Phil Walsh, a former British pro, trained Rium as a forward, a role he believed Rium could manage against younger, high-level players. Jennifer Lopez's former massage therapist contributed to his training. At home, Rium incorporated cold tubs and body vibration therapy. U.S. soccer CEO J.T. Batson offered simpler advice, quote, stretch. Rium scaled back some weekly hours at M13, the venture firm he co-founded with his younger brother, Carter. In one whirlwind weekend last month, Rium trained in L.A. on Saturday, raced to the Coachella Music Festival in Indio, California for the evening, then returned to the soccer field the following afternoon. Finally, in late April, Rium arrived in the tiny northern town of Villaverde to join his new team. He was formally introduced last Thursday, getting jersey number 78, a nod to his birth year. Some local residents recognized him, and he garnered significant attention from the Portuguese media, though that had much to do with his status as Paris Hilton's brother-in-law. On Sunday, the moment finally arrived. In the waning minutes of Villaverdense's crucial gain against Torrens, Rium jogged onto the pitch for his pro debut. Quote, it hasn't quite sunk in, Rium said afterward. I genuinely felt great out there. I felt like I could do something. Unfortunately for Villaverdense, Rium couldn't do quite enough. The team's 1-0 loss confirmed its relegation to the third division next season. The stadium was mostly empty on Sunday, though a VIP box teemed with Reum's family and friends. The public was less enthralled. A Portuguese journalist lumped Reum in with other oddball soccer signings, while others questioned the club's decision to let him live out his dream. For his part, Reum plans to stay in Portugal for Villaverdense's final two games of the season. He is also discussing how he might stay involved with the club next season and beyond. "It would be nicer to be in Saint-Tropez," he said, "but I committed to doing this." And we are going to finish up with some of the What's News headlines. One of the little headlines is, the little blurbs, is the S&P 500 and Dow rose 0.1% and 0.2% respectively, with the broad-based index building on its recent rally. The NASDAQ slipped 0.1%. The next small paragraph is Tom Zhu, who is credited with turning Tesla's Shanghai factory into a stellar performer, is set to return to China, where the electric vehicle maker's sales have declined. The next blurb is Reddit reported its first results as a public company, with the social media platform reporting better than expected revenue and a narrower than expected loss for the first quarter. The next blurb is Uber and Instacart formed an unlikely partnership that will allow customers to order Uber Eats restaurant food through the Instacart app. Next blurb, BP plans to cut at least $2 billion in costs after its profit was hit by lower oil and gas prices and an outage at the U.S. refinery. Okay, this concludes the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, May 8th, 2024. My name is Ed Goldman. Have a wonderful day.